Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and here at Bruegel, we are undergoing a research project on the future of work and inclusive growth in Europe. The project analyzes the impact of technology on the nature, quantity, and quality of work, welfare systems, and inclusive growth at large. The Sound of Economics is proud to contribute to the project with a space for discussion and analysis on this theme. And I'm happy to be accompanied today by Laura Nursky, who coordinates this project at Bruegel, and Mia Hoffman, who is also working on the project here. Hi, Laura and Mia, how are you?
Hi, Giuseppe. I'm very well, thank you. I'm very happy to be sharing this podcast with Mia, my very talented research assistant who has finished her time at Bruegel.
Amazing to have you, Mia, here for your first podcast ever.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here and very happy to present our latest research today.
And for our listeners, this is a special podcast because for the first time since the beginning of the pandemic, we are three people in the studio and we don't have anyone connected via Zoom. So this is very special for me too. So thank you so much. In today's episode, we are going to contribute to speak about jobs quality, which we started to discuss in our previous episodes on our Future Work series at The Sound of Economics, and you will find that specific episode in the show notes. This time, we will focus, however, on the impact of artificial intelligence on jobs quality. AI, like any workplace technology, changes the division of labor in an organization and the resulting design of jobs. As we will see, the use of algorithmic innovation has an impact on tasks, on organizations, and overall on the nature of jobs. And this is an ongoing transformation. Mia and Laura, you have been recently publishing a working paper exploring the topic in depth. So to start with, and as a reminder for our listeners, what is job quality and how is it shaped?
Sure. So job quality is a bundle of all those elements of a job that impact the well-being of a person in the job. So you can, you know that jobs have many different elements that can all influence a person's well-being. So that includes, for example, contractual conditions like wages and schedules and physical working conditions like safety and ergonomic aspects. But also, very importantly, it includes the social relationships in the workplace and the job content. So social relationships, I'm sure you and our listeners can imagine what that entails. It means getting emotional support from colleagues and your managers. But job content is a bit more difficult concept to grasp. It relates to the nature of the tasks that a worker does during the 8 hours of his workday. So psychological research usually divides job content into two buckets. The bucket of job demands. Those are demands that are being placed on workers, that workers are expected to complete, and that require some effort from the worker. It's usually measured by indicators like work intensity or also the emotional load of a job, especially in a job that requires a lot of human interaction, like in a teacher or a nurse or a service job. The second bucket in job content is the bucket of the job resources. And those are elements in a job that actually help the worker or support the worker to execute the demands. And those include, very importantly, for example, autonomy to make certain decisions, getting feedback about how you're doing, but also support in a different sense. So not support in the emotional sense, but instrumental support. So when you're stuck on something, that you have resources, colleagues that can help you resolve those problems. And very importantly to understand is that out of all of these elements that that together combine into job quality, the most important predictor of well-being in a job is actually job content.
Yeah, so that was the result of this big meta-analytic study in work design that collected over 250 papers that covered more than 200,000 participants. And this study found that job content variables explain around 34% of variation in job satisfaction. And social relationships explained 17%, while physical working conditions only explain or account for 4% of variation in job satisfaction. And this really shows that job demands and resources that relate to job content are a much more important aspect of job quality than other aspects that Laura just described. But coming back to the second part of your question, Giuseppe, what is really interesting is to understand how the design of an individual job emerges from the wider structure of work in an organization.
Yes, indeed, Mia, that's very true. So it's important to understand this link between an individual job and the wider organization of work. So in fact, what determines the content of one individual job is a result of a division of labor across people in an organization and the degree of specialization in that firm. So when organizations, for example, are very hierarchical or decision-making is very concentrated, it's likely that the person below has little autonomy to solve problems in his or her own work. Or when organizations make jobs highly specialized, for example, saying to a worker, we only want you to execute one type of task or deal with one type of customer or handle one type of product. This allows specialization, so it increases efficiency, but it also makes jobs more repetitive. So they have less variation and less opportunity to learn something new. So now we finally get to AI, which is what we argue in the paper, is that AI, indeed, like any technology that is deployed in the workplace, it changes this division of labor and it changes the resulting design of jobs.
So like, automating away some tasks that were previously handled by workers. Now they are performed by artificial intelligence.
Yeah, so automation is this classic use case that everybody immediately thinks of when we talk about new technologies in the workplace. And it's definitely true that AI technology can now take over other tasks that previously previous automation technology just couldn't do, like analytical and cognitive tasks. But at this point, I can assure everyone who's worried that mass unemployment does not seem to be the most likely outcome of AI implementation in the workplace. There was this really good paper by the OECD that came out last year that looked at what happened to all of these jobs that were always supposedly at risk of automation. And what they found is that highly automatable jobs still continued to have employment growth, but that this growth was just a lot slower than in other occupations that kept growing, for instance, in the IT sector or healthcare workers. So while we see lower employment growth in automatable occupations, we do not see mass layoffs at all.
As we discuss in the paper, one of those reasons is that jobs usually don't consist of a single task that can be automated, but they are made up of a bundle of activities, tasks, duties, decision-making. And even though some of them might be automated, there are very few jobs today that can be replaced completely. Let's think, for example, of a data scientist, which is a job I know very well because I used to be a data scientist myself. Data scientists have some tasks that might be a bit repetitive, like getting access to certain data sets, updating the data in time, cleaning the data, checking the data if there's missing values, if it's balanced right and such. And you might think that some of those tasks can be automated. However, there's also a lot of other tasks that a data scientist has in his job. It's understanding the problem that needs to be solved with the data. It's making sure that the right model is selected to answer this question. It's reporting about the results of the model, communicating it to the decision maker that needs to base his decision on what the model has found. So indeed, some of those tasks might be automated, but for sure, this job cannot be completely automated.
So instead of automation, what we actually found in our research to be a much more relevant or much more widely used application of AI is algorithmic management. So instead of automating production tasks in the organization, so coming back to the structure of work that Laura mentioned beginning, so instead of placing robots at an assembly line, AI really rather changes the governance structure of an organization and not so much the production structure.
So are you basically saying that the artificial intelligence is changing only the way the tasks are performed, but also the way the tasks are assigned to workers? I mean, what exactly is algorithmic management? Also because it comes to my mind, when we speak about something related to automatizing management, the question how much it relates to surveillance and monitoring in the workplace, for instance.
So algorithmic management is really a broad general term that just describes any time a software algorithm takes over a management function. So anytime something that your human supervisor would do is done by an algorithm. And indeed, we've seen a lot during the research for this paper that monitoring and surveillance is an important part of algorithmic management and very common application. And important to understand is that this implies a shift in the nature of worker monitoring. So from a human supervisor, who does surveillance by supervision, as the word implies, algorithmic monitoring is basically surveillance by data collection. And this is a lot more pervasive because it allows to track aspects of worker behavior that previously were not being able to supervise, for instance, remote work. And it is also a lot more, you know, permanent and continuous, so there are no breaks for workers. So, for example, package delivery drivers are often... So this is an example we came across to, while we're writing the paper. They are often under very tight schedules today to achieve all their stops. And because this is such a competitive industry, there are very strict protocols in place to optimize all, you know, processes of delivery for efficiency. And modern delivery trucks have today been equipped with a huge number of sensors that track everything that happens in and around the truck, including, you know, putting the seatbelt on, opening the doors, you know, opening the windows, braking, and so on. And now anytime a worker actually deviates from this very strict efficiency protocol, this is noted by the sensors in the truck, and they need to justify this kind of shift or difference in behavior to their supervisor. And what this does is that the surveillance itself creates a lot of stress. It discourages breaks, right? Mm. You don't feel like you can take a break if it's recorded by the car and you have to later say, oh, I was on the phone for 5 minutes. And it lowers workers' autonomy on how to do their job, obviously. And ultimately, it will also reduce their trust in their employer because surveillance does imply that the employer doesn't trust you. And on top of that, the data from worker monitoring is then often used to evaluate their performance. And platforms are notorious for having this fully automated data collection and performance evaluation process, and even punishing workers when they don't perform to expected benchmarks.
Mia, on this algorithmic performance evaluation, in your reading of the literature, you came across many interesting examples. Can you give our listeners maybe one of those?
Yeah, so one of the most salient examples that we've seen is that of an Uber driver. And if they don't achieve a certain score in their performance, they risk to be temporarily suspended, or might even their profiles might even be permanently deactivated. This includes, you know, having a good enough customer rating or having accepting enough of the ride requests they receive. And what this does is really it creates an incentive structure that makes them behave in a way that is compliant with the organization's goals and interests. And this really undermines workers' discretion over how to do their job, which is particularly striking actually in platform work, which is supposed to be super flexible. That's how it advertised.
Right, Mia. And also, Giuseppe, not everything that is valuable at work can be quantified, which is a big risk. If you use data to evaluate performance, you're always missing some efforts of workers, for example, helping a colleague in need that is not quantified. And that's a big risk in these type of data-driven performance evaluation systems.
And what other examples of algorithmic management you found in your research? And you definitely point to the risks of those systems. Are there also opportunities in things that you've found, or is sure. that mainly quite a warning signal that you are sending to people working in organizing mm-hmm. work?
No, sure.
And so, jobs.
Yes, sure. So two other interesting applications that we came across in our reading of the literature and that have also pervasive effects on the nature and the quality of jobs are algorithms that take over the planning and the scheduling of the work, or when to do the work, and algorithms that deliver detailed instructions on how to do the work. And to come to your question about if they bring only risks or also opportunities in the examples I'm going to give, you will see that it depends on how they are implemented. They can be implemented in a supportive way that really give the worker more autonomy over his job, or they can be implemented in a very restrictive way, which take away autonomy of the worker. So let's have a look first at the algorithmic scheduling examples. So we see, for example, the algorithmic scheduling of shifts, which is when an algorithm uses real-time data on, for example, traffic, weather, and other demand indicators to predict the optimal level of people in a shift at any certain point. So, of course, you can imagine that this allows employers to cut labor costs because there's never too many people present in the shift. On the other hand, for the people that are in the shift, it raises the work intensity. Because there's only ever just enough people there to do the work, and there's never any slow period in which a worker can recuperate. Also, it makes these shifts very unpredictable because employers might adapt the shifts to changes in prediction in the weather, for example. So for the worker, it might be very unpredictable to know when he's supposed to go to work. And research shows that this unpredictability is very harmful for the physical health of the worker, but also the financial security of the worker. Now, beyond scheduling shifts, we've also seen applications of scheduling of tasks within a shift. So these are examples when an algorithm tells you the order in which you need to complete your task. For example, we've seen an application of a scheduling algorithm in a hotel that told hotel housekeepers when to clean which room. So how this happened before in the hotel is the hotel assigned a complete floor to one cleaner. And within that floor, the cleaner could choose when to clean which room. She would watch when people would leave their room, and she would know when they would return, if they would return that same day or if they would check out completely. And based on that, she would say, I'll clean first the room of the person who is coming back today to make sure they have a clean room, and then I'll clean the ones who are checking out. I know they have to be clean by 3 p.m. because that's when the new guests arrive and such. So she had a lot of autonomy on how to organize her workday. Now, in this example, the hotel introduced an app that sends signals to the workers about when to clean which room based on the instant information of who's checking out. Oh, we have a new guest coming in. They want a room immediately. So the hotel wanted to make those rooms available as quick as possible. So that reduced the autonomy of the worker. And in this example, the worker didn't have any option for saying, this doesn't work for me for this or that reason. There was no option in the app to say no, right? So that's one example of that make it harmful if there's no way to say no to the algorithm. And we're going to come back later in the episode about other aspects that make these algorithms work better. But I also wanted to talk about the example of algorithmic work method instructions, which is a very different type of algorithmic management. But they also range from not very harmful to very harmful. So these are algorithms that tell you not when to do your work, but how to do it. And in the least harmful application we've seen, these algorithms just give you the right information at the right time to the right person. For example, you can think of these Google Glasses applications. They can give you all the information right in your field of view, right when you need it. But then they might still say, you can choose what to do with this information,
right?
Whether to use it or not. An example we've seen was of anesthesiologists, so doctors in the hospital that perform anesthesia. And these doctors have to monitor a whole lot of information at once. They have to monitor the heart rate, the breathing, also look at the skin color of the patient. They have to monitor the patient is exhaling and inhaling and all of that. So before the Google glasses, they would have to monitor several screens and also look at the patient at the same time, which in stressful periods was a lot of information to monitor. With these glasses, they received all the information in their field of view. But the glasses only provided information. They didn't tell them what to do with this information. And these doctors actually were very enthusiastic about this this pilot study. And at the end of the trial period, they asked the doctors, how can we make this technology work even better for you? And they even said, well, we just want to see even more information. So they started listing all of the information that they would find also valuable to have. They said, maybe we can swipe through the glasses, or maybe we can also get auditive information in our ears. So they were very enthusiastic about more information. But what they didn't want, what they asked them and they said no, is they didn't want decision support from the glasses. So they didn't want the glasses to tell them, hey, careful, now your patient is in danger and now you need to do this or that medical intervention to save your patient. They wanted to keep that decision for themselves. And since these are high status people in the hospital, of course, the technology designers took their wishes into account.
But now, that's not the case for other tasks.
No, indeed. So more harmful applications we've seen of these work method instructions, for example, are these voice recognition systems in call centers that monitor conversations between call center operators and clients who are calling the call center, who are angry about something, and giving them live feedback on how the conversation is going. So this is emotion recognition, and the system will tell you, oh, careful, your client is getting angry. Maybe you should suggest this or that, or maybe you should lower your voice, or maybe you should speak slower, or maybe you should do this or this or that. If it's just feedback, you could still think it might be helpful. It all, again, depends on how it's implemented. If at the same time the system sends a signal to your boss warning him, uh-oh, this conversation is getting out of hand, then again, this is very stressful for the worker and it reduces their own autonomy on how to handle this conversation with the worker. Finally, we've seen many more examples. Maybe one of them we'll give later in the episode. Also in warehouses, people are getting step-by-step instructions on how to move through the warehouse, which route to take. All of these work method instruction examples have a risk of de-skilling, so that people in the end lose their ability to make their own decisions on how to do the work. They have less opportunity for learning. And we know that this type of autonomy, this autonomy to try out new things and to maybe fail but learn and get better at something, that this is, if you lose this type of autonomy, it's very bad for motivation, engagement, and job satisfaction.
So all you're saying basically boils down to all these effects that algorithm management has on job quality aspects like autonomy, work intensity, and skill development. But coming back to automation, Mia, can I assume that automation is neutral for job quality?
No, not necessarily, unfortunately. So, of course, if a job is automated away completely, there is no job quality impact because there is no longer a job left to be affected. But as soon as some parts of the job are not automatable, there is a job quality impact, of course. So there are jobs, for instance, that can almost completely be automated, but where you do need a human in the loop to monitor what the algorithm does, basically. This is the case, for instance, for airline pilots. When they are on autopilot, they need to take off, they need to do the landing, and they are on autopilot usually when they are in the air. But this is when they mostly monitor, you know, all the metrics that are displayed to them, and the algorithm takes care of the rest. I mean, it's a bit simplified, but yes, that's how, kind of how it works. And in these types of monitoring jobs, there's always this risk of skill loss and skill degradation because they don't actually actively execute the tasks anymore. So what these workers need is a lot of training to maintain their capacity to intervene in case something goes wrong. And we know that other jobs that are subject to some automation will also turn into these monitoring jobs. So it will be very important to introduce this training infrastructure to also to enable workers in these kind of jobs that will change to maintain their skills and don't lose them. But most cases, it's just the composition of tasks in the job that will change. So like we mentioned before, jobs are not fully automatable, but there are a lot of tasks, individual tasks of a job that can be replaced by machinery. So the overall effect of job quality will really depend on what kind of tasks replace those that are taken away. This means also that the effect will be very different from job to job, right? For instance, you know, think of if we take away all the boring and repetitive tasks of your job, and workers then get to spend a lot more time on, you know, challenging or creative activities. So this will be great for their skills variety. They get to use skills that they wouldn't otherwise use as much in their job. And it might also make their jobs more meaningful, so they might be more happy. But there are two reasons why automating away all of the boring and repetitive aspects of your job are not such a good idea. First, the first is that work intensity will increase. This is because by taking away all of the boring stuff, you also take away the mental relief that workers get from the more challenging aspects of their job while they do these tasks. I think so. We can all relate, for instance, if you have a big project and you just finished it, you know, you're kind of exhausted and then you're happy to just spend an hour, you know, cleaning your inbox and answering some emails to get some
downtime.
Exactly. And the second reason why we shouldn't automate all the boring tasks away is that often doing these simple and repetitive tasks brings some added value beyond just executing them. For instance, so coming back to Laura's example of the data scientists, they were offered an algorithm that could do their data cleaning for them. Data cleaning is a huge part of all data scientists' work, of course. And in the end, they did say they didn't want it. And this is because when you do data cleaning, you learn a lot also already about the structure of your data. This includes, for instance, the structure, the variable coding, but also if there are, you know, imbalances, missing observations. And they said that the stuff, the information they learn about their data sets while data cleaning then feeds into their modeling. So if they have an algorithm that does all their data cleaning for them, they have to invest the time later to learn about their data sets before they do the modeling. So it's not actually more efficient, and it just takes away this downtime.
That makes sense just from anecdotal reference. You mentioned the Uber drivers before and about the de-skilling of things. I mean, we've been seeing more and more that people rely just on maps. I mean, not just Uber drivers, but that's quite more evident there. They just rely on maps apps for driving from one place to another. While before, people were kind of forced, or like they needed to know the streets of the city where they were operating, and they almost knew all the streets by heart. And nowadays, you end up with as soon as the GPS gets a little bit of a bug, you end up somewhere else in the city, and you know, the clients get quite angry at the drivers for things like that. But you know, poor drivers, they don't really have. They lost the skills that they used to have before, and they need to rely on the software that is provided by the company, because they are obliged to use that specific software, as Laura mentioned before. So the question here, is how can we make sure that artificial intelligence doesn't harm job quality?
Indeed, Giuseppe. So that's the question that we want to answer in the paper foremost. But in order to do that, it's important to understand that these effects that we've described so far, these potential harmful effects, they do not happen to all jobs and to all people to the same extent. In fact, some jobs are much more exposed to algorithmic management than others. Studies actually detail how pervasive data collection and surveillance systems are often first introduced in low-wage occupations where workers have low bargaining power. And this just goes to show that technology is a product of power, which is one of the titles of one of your previous podcasts. And therefore, it replicates existing power dynamics in society. Big tech, for example, which is the place where most of AI nowadays is being developed, is notorious for its lack in diversity in gender and race. So as a result, disadvantaged groups suffer more of the negative consequences of AI. For example, workers of color and especially women of color in jobs like retail and food service jobs, they are disproportionately exposed to these just-in-time scheduling algorithms that I discussed before. And beyond the harmful effects to themselves, which I described, like harmful to their health and economic security, they are also harmful in an intergenerational sense because these unpredictable schedules make childcare arrangements more difficult, especially in single-parent households. And this induces anxiety in both the parents and the children. And therefore, it can even replicate inequalities across generations. So the only way to mitigate these potential negative effects of AI adoption on workers is to counterbalance these power imbalances in the workplace through meaningful worker participation. And workers can get involved in many different stages of technology implementation, early on when the technology is being designed or even selected, which technology to use, all the way up to the implementation of the technology, integrating it in the operational processes or debugging the technology. However, so research shows that the earlier workers are involved in the technology adoption process, the better. And labor legislation should facilitate that.
And then there's actually also the difference in terms of influence. You know, do workers just get to share their opinions about the new technology, or do they have formal decision-making rights? This is also an important determinant of their influence. But beyond that, worker involvement in designing these systems can also actually make algorithms better for everybody who's involved. And that's because workers have a much better understanding of their jobs than their managers do or the technology developers do. And this knowledge, what makes the job good and what determines good performance, this should really be leveraged more. So for example, Laura mentioned earlier the example of the housekeepers and task assignment algorithm. So housekeepers knew that guests that would be staying, they would like their rooms to be clean when by the time they return in the afternoon, right? So they would prioritize this, and they would prioritize their rooms over cleaning rooms of checked out guests. But since the algorithm wanted, to maximize room turnover, make it available for new guests, the housekeepers often didn't have the time, actually to clean the staying guests' rooms before they returned. And this led to a lot of complaints and increasing complaint and, was actually eventually not better for the whole hotel. So had the housekeepers' knowledge of this information's informal work organization, knowledge been taken into account, everybody probably would have benefited from it. But most importantly, so beyond making system design better, worker participation can just ensure that algorithms are not kind of imposed on the workforce, but are adopted in collaboration with them so that they also get to reap some of the benefits and the, for instance, productivity benefits that ensue from using this technology in their workplace. And worker involvement is also a crucial tool to kind of make sure these basic AI ethic principles are respected in their workplace. This includes transparency and also algorithmic fairness, so no bias, for instance, and human influence. So having the ability to say no when the task assignment algorithm assigns you a room and you say, no, this does not make sense. So giving workers the opportunity to override, for instance, instructions and assignments. And then shape what this looks like in their specific workplace. These are, I think, the main outcomes that worker participation can achieve.
And isn't all what you're saying even worse in the platform economy? Is that why the Platform Workers Directive aims to regulate the algorithmic management at the EU level, for instance?
So it's definitely true that labor platforms feature many of the just described, algorithmic management functions that we talked about. For instance, algorithmic scheduling is really common in, food delivery or other, on-site gig work like cleaning, housekeeping. And most platforms have this automated performance evaluation system. But during our research, what we found and what we also found quite worrying is that algorithmic management isn't at all confined to platform work anymore, and it's emerging more and more in traditional sectors of employment as well. So algorithmic scheduling is used very commonly in all shift work and all sectors that use shift work, like healthcare or retail, for instance. And work instructions are increasingly being used in manufacturing and assembly. So where workers are told exactly step by step, you know, now you take this piece and you put it here. So they don't actually have to think so much about or learn about how to assemble different products. But what we thought was most worrying is actually this trend of gamification, which is mostly deployed in warehouses and logistics. So this is based on performance monitoring, and the general idea is to use game-like components in the workplace to get workers to work harder or faster or just more productively. This can look in different ways. So it can be countdowns, you know, telling workers how many seconds they have left to complete their tasks or how many seconds they have to retrieve this item from the warehouse, you know, giving them a congratulations when they achieve it in time. Or there could be big scoreboards hanging very visibly that show everybody's performance and rank workers against each other. And of course, this creates a very high intensity and high pressure work environment and actually stimulates competition between colleagues, which is really bad for team spirit and team morale, of course. And it just pushes workers, you know, to overexert themselves, to ignore safety precautions in order to somehow make this target, putting their own health at risk and sometimes even others as well. And in the short run, sure, this might increase productivity, but what we see and what we expect also to see even more is that just worker turnover will increase a lot.
Yeah, so like Mia just explained, we've come across many, many examples of algorithmic management outside of the platform economy. But of course, that's where it originated in platform work. So probably that is why we see the first regulations on algorithmic management taking place exactly in platform work. And the European Commission's proposal to improve the working conditions of platform workers has as a main aim actually to ensure that platform workers are granted the legal employment status that corresponds to their actual work arrangements. But it also indeed provides them with rights in the context of algorithmic management systems. So when I was reading the draft regulation, I noticed that it tries to address several of these design principles that Mia mentioned on transparency and human control of AI systems quite explicitly, which is a good thing. It also tries to address this fairness principle that Mia mentioned. It requires platforms to evaluate any potential risks of accidents or psychosocial harm that might follow from these systems. It also talks about introducing preventative and protective measures against these risks. However, fairness, it's a very broad concept, and we've come across many other potential unfair effects of algorithmic management that we detail in the paper. Things like redefinitions of paid working time, reduction in efficiency wages, de-skilling, asymmetric information, unfair performance evaluation, so many, many more potential unfair effects. So of course, this is still something that might not be sufficiently covered by the current proposal. But given that the Platform Work Directive is in its nature a labor regulation, it does explicitly safeguard worker consultation when algorithmic management is introduced. But its main limitation is that it only protects people that are working through platforms, right? So as Mia just discussed, it's getting more pervasive also outside of platform work, which is so far not regulated at all. Of course, we also have the infamous AI Act, or the proposal for an AI regulation at the European level. And this proposal does list employment as one of the 8 high-risk areas that will need additional protections. But since this regulation is actually a product safety regulation and not a labor regulation, it has some crucial gaps related to workplace implementations of AI. For example, it details the responsibilities of the developer of a system and the user of a system, but it doesn't specify the responsibilities of an employer vis-a-vis the developer of a system, which in this case might be 2 different parties, or it might be the same party, depending if the system is developed in-house or sourced from the market. It also leaves the risk assessment that high-risk systems need to execute up to self-assessment by the provider. And of course, in the context of the workplace, a self-assessment by the employer of potential risks for the worker is not sufficient because of these existing power imbalances that we talked about. So in the workplace, implementations of AI, worker representation and trade unions should be involved in order to correctly assess any potential risks associated with these systems. But the current proposal doesn't mention the role of social partners in shaping the use of AI systems at work at all, which is also another crucial gap.
So basically, there is still quite a lot to do, a long way to do in terms of regulating the use of AI at work, and also a long way to do to go in order to assess the risks which you are trying to do in your paper, but basically it's a very important aspect of the work that in general the project is doing on trying to get into the new challenges of the future work. Unfortunately, we cannot have much more time for this episode, but we are going to keep discussing about jobs quality in the frame of the project, both in terms of further publications and tools which are going to be published on our website www.bruegel.org, but also here at the Sound of Economics in our series that is following the project together with Laura and other guests. We are going to keep these conversations going on. So thanks a lot, Laura and Mia. I would like also to remind everyone that in the show notes there is a link to the working paper that you have written on exactly this topic, and that as usual you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars still on our website. So thanks a lot for joining the Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye bye.
Thank you, Giuseppe.
Thank you, Giuseppe. Bye bye.
Bye bye.